Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a poet and a novelist. He's the author of four novels and one narrative poem. And without exception, each work has been showered with praise. He's been winning prizes since he was first published in 2007. From the Sunday Times Young Writers Award for his debut, The Truth About These Strange Times, to the Costa Poetry Prize for The Broken Word. He's been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, won the European Union Prize for Literature, and been named as one of Granta's 20 best British novelists under 40. Adam Foulds, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, that's just a short section of some of the things that you've won or been shortlisted for. And it seems extraordinary then that in your early life, being a novelist didn't really feature. You thought you wanted to be a zoologist.
Oh, yes, that's true. Early on, aged around 10 or so, I became a very passionate bird watcher and very interested in natural history and thought I would go on to study zoology. So took the GCSEs that were appropriate for that. And during the middle of that period, when I was around 15, I had an English teacher suggest that I write a poem for an English class. And that somehow just tumbled the lock in my psyche kind of immediately. And I felt very strongly that that was who I was and what I wanted to do. And so had a very definite and very fortunate sense of kind of vocation immediately. Fortunate, I say, because it made my kind of identity very clear to me and my life choices, at least academically, very simple. I just followed the path that allowed me to spend time with the literature that I loved and that would enable me to continue writing.
I mean, your teachers recognise this too. They even suggested that you keep your early work because one day it would be in demand from academics.
Yes, that's true. I mean, and I'm profoundly grateful to the very good and very attentive teachers that I had at that age. Their interest in my work and their sense that it was worthwhile and worth pursuing really gave me a bedrock of confidence and a sense of purpose that enabled me to carry on through the lean years that were inevitable and the rejections that are inevitable, I think. 99% of writers receive more rejections than they receive acceptances. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly true for me early on. And you have to be tough and pig-headed to keep going. So having those early messages of encouragement in my memory bank enabled me to do that.
What about your parents? Were they encouraging?
Certainly, yes. I'm very lucky. I have very nice and supportive parents. I'm one of four children. They've been very encouraging and supportive of all of us in our various paths.
Your father started off as an accountant, but he later trained as a rabbi.
That's right, yes. He took early retirement, having gone, I think, as far as he could in his accountancy career and worked as a rabbi for a number of years. I'd already left home by the time this happened, but it was fascinating and very satisfying to watch him go through that process. He'd always had trained as an accountant, had a vocational education and a very successful career as an accountant, and it was wonderful to kind of piggyback on his studies and see what it was that he was learning and to watch the expansion of his world at that time.
Mm, because, of course, some of your earliest literary influences were Philip Roth and Saul Bellow.
Yeah, that's true. So I guess what we're saying here is I come from a Jewish background, northeast London, end of the central line, suburban Jewish kid. I got very interested in poetry. And then later on, as I became interested in prose, there was a particular thing that happened when I read Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and Malamud and the other great American Jewish novelists, which was to find my world very directly reported and recreated in their fiction, something which happens much less frequently, it seems, in lyric poetry. It's one of those moments that happens with lots of people in lots of different identities where you realise that you've been living in a marginal culture, that your terms of cultural reference are not shared by the majority population, when you feel a kind of intensity of reaction when you find your world reflected back at you.
Mm-hmm. You went on to study creative writing at the fabulous UEA, University of East Anglia, MA Creative Writing course, under, again, some very influential tutors like Craig Raine.
Well, Craig Raine actually was a tutor that I had when I was doing my undergraduate degree. I was not at the college that he taught at, but I did take some classes with him, and I took a creative writing module that he gave, really. It didn't count towards one's degree at all, but it was a thing that he did for one term each year. You could submit some poems or whatever kind of writing, and if he took you on, you would then in a small circle of writers who would meet once a week. It was a very good course, actually. It was taught thematically, and it was a two-hour session. Spent an hour and a half reading examples of things that he had brought together on that theme, action writing, whatever it might be. And then in the last half hour, we would quickly respond to each other's poems that we'd submitted for that week and that had been circulated beforehand, which is the right proportion at that stage of actually just absorbing and reading to critical personal response.
Mm. On to the UEA course, because I mean that's world renowned for producing amazing writers. Did you find that was your launch pad?
It certainly helped. I mean, it was recommended to me to do by Craig on the basis that if you can get the money together for it, then you've got a year to write. And at the very least on that level, it's a good thing to do. I went through the poetry stream, although I was starting to write more prose than poetry at that time. I had two fantastic tutors in Andrew Motion and Denise Riley, people whose work lives with me and who I'm still occasionally in conversation with. So fantastic in the workshop experience. Certainly the profile of that course means that you can be assured that when you are sending your first writings out to prospective agents in that kind of flailing, hopeful way that you do, you're fairly sure that it will get read. Mm. And that's clearly an enormous advantage. That said, I left UEA not yet ready really to be taken on by an agent and possibly attempting that too soon. And I had a slightly kind of bumpy time before I settled with my first agent. But it was because I had things to learn. I had writing to develop. And actually, the main thing I had to learn is that in that first stage, what you really need is a completed first novel, because agents, generally speaking, are not interested in taking on someone who hasn't yet completed at least one novel. It's a very hard and unlikely thing to do, and the only way to prove that you can is to have done it. This was in the beyond the late 90s, around kind of 2000, 2001, where there had been a lot of these very kind of big, splashy book deals for young writers who just submitted a couple of chapters. And so it was a time of big advances for the Saffron Foers and the Zadie Smiths of this world.
Which sadly don't exist anymore.
No.
You were working at that time in jobs, though, completely unrelated to writing or publishing. Do you think that that's an advantage?
It certainly helped. It certainly fed into my writing. And it helped that helped me, at least, that I didn't stay in an academic environment, that I didn't go on to do a PhD, which was a kind of quite a natural thought for me. It caused some anxiety later on in that period, because I had only ever taken on jobs that were simply to pay the rent and that allowed me all of my mental space for my writing, which I was doing in that time in my lunch breaks before work. I was using my holiday periods to write in as well. So I was working in retail. I worked in a warehouse for a while, and that's fine and very interesting. And some of that experience goes very directly into my first novel. But, you know, passing through being 30, getting 31, and having taken that course and the possibility that the first novel won't happen, won't get picked up, you realise that you've taken a big risk. Mm-hmm. So it got a little scary towards the end, but fortunately worked out.
Well, it worked out supremely well, because The Truth About These Strange Times won the Betty Chask Award at the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Award. I mean, that's an incredible result for a debut novel. Tell us a little bit about that book.
So I'll start with the characters. It has a central character who is called Howard. He's living in Burnley in the north of England, although he's of Scottish origin, from Glasgow originally. He is the child of a mother who has recently died. He is working part-time in a gym, as a kind of menial person in a gym. And he is a kind of diffuse personality, unambitious. At one point I'd describe him as not lazy, just naturally at rest. So someone who is like picking up the sweaty towels in the gym, who's bumbling along on his own. Someone who for a lot of people, a lot of the time, would just be in your peripheral vision and certainly counts for nothing significant socially. And he, through a set of circumstances, ends up in the company of a family with a son who takes part in memory competitions and is a sort of hot-housed child of very ambitious parents. So there are these two very highly contrasting situations, the kind of socially invisible, unambitious person who is nonetheless, I hope, very engaging and humanly valuable, set against someone who is constantly having their value measured in a kind of competitive, meritocratic way. It ends up with them, Howard and the boy Saul, running away together and being fugitive for a while. And it's a kind of comic novel it's meant to be funny a lot of the time. Those are the characters. What I had as its kind of philosophical centre that I was kind of chewing away at was looking at this idea of contingent or non-contingent human value, to look at what makes a person valuable and how a person might inhabit the world and experience, both in terms of socially visible kinds of success and more nebulous but nevertheless essential human qualities.
And the book was, as we say, a huge success. Is that one of the reasons why you changed gear for your next work and went into poetry rather than stick with prose?
No, that happened because, well, for a number of reasons. I was sending around The Truth About These Strange Times to agents looking for it to find a home. And in that period, I couldn't bring myself to begin another novel because I didn't know if this first one would happen. So I didn't want to set off on something large scale and commit myself to another couple of years on something. So I wanted to write something smaller. The subject matter of the poem, which has to do with the Mau Mau uprising and the internment camp system in British Kenya in the mid-50s, was something that came into my life and struck me in the form of a review of two very significant works of history that were published around the same time about this story, one by a Harvard historian called Caroline Elkins, her book Britain's Gulag, and one by a British historian called David Anderson, it's called Histories of the Hanged. And I was very struck by this material, partly because I had not really heard about it before, which obviously to some extent is my fault, it's my ignorance, but also it felt like that silence about a very intense conflict that happened very much within living memory was something that was repressed in British cultural memory. And that intrigued me. And it chimed, I guess, with my Jewish cultural background, with having a strong imagination structuring education in Holocaust history, and amongst other things, therefore being aware of the processes of bringing people to justice after the Holocaust, sometimes long time after the Holocaust, and being aware that this was something that hadn't happened around this conflict, which did involve a large amount of extrajudicial killing, and that there would be British people, either in Kenya or, you know, maybe in golf club bars in the home counties, who had lived through this and participated in it. And that seemed to me outrageous and compelling, and I wanted to break that silence. I wanted to join in with breaking that silence in the way that these works of history had done. It took the form of a poem in particular because I wanted to write it in a very hard, stripped down, classical way. I didn't want to editorialize about what was happening. I wrote it from the perspective of a young boy, young British boy, who's going through these experiences. And I wanted the reader to have his experience, which was to be suddenly picked up by these events that accelerate and intensify, and to be spat out at the end of it as that individual would have been, having to make sense of it for himself. That seemed to me obviously true for a lot of these experiences of historical crisis, particularly in the 20th century, you know, that people, millions of people were caught up in serious conflicts, mad things happened, they come out the other side of them into a post-war peace of various times, and often were not discussing those events afterwards. They lived with those memories. They were sealed once again into a kind of normal, peaceful civilian life and lived with those as just purely kind of internal realities.
And history again formed the backbone of your, or historical research then formed the backbone of your next piece of work, The Quickening Maze.
Yes. The idea, that material came to mind, came to light for me as an undergraduate, actually reading about Tennyson and about Clare. I was very interested in Clare. This is in the 90s. There was a big sort of Clare revival going on. There lots of interesting stuff being written about him. I had just missed at Oxford Seamus Heaney's period as professor of poetry there, but his Oxford lectures had just been published, including a very good one on John Clare. I did go to Tom Paulin's classes. He was a big John Clare advocate and critic. So I was very interested in him. I read Peter Levy's, I think it was, biography of Tennyson and discover that Tennyson and Clare had been in the same place at the same time and that this place was very near where I'd grown up. So suddenly these two very charismatic and interesting ghosts kind of materialised in my own back garden. Mm. And I thought, I want to write about this in some way at some point. But I didn't want to do it until I thought I would be capable of doing it in a way that, well, that would satisfy me and that also allowed me a little more of the temerity required to take on writing about and somewhat in the consciousness of these two extraordinary literary figures. So as I say, it was over a period of years that I read and absorbed material about them, obviously with a very intense period when I finally, after The Broken Word, thought that this was the moment to write that book.
And it was incredibly successful. It won the Encore Award, the European Union Prize for Literature, shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. And that, of course, was the year that Hilary Mantel won.
Yes.
Really, really strong shortlist, Mantel ultimately triumphing. And it was shortlisted also for the Walter Scott Prize for Historical Fiction. There was then a big break. Why the long gap between that and your next book, In the Wolf's Mouth?
I think those first three books came out in successive years, which was is a very unusual thing to have happened. Mm. And that's partly because The Broken Word came fast and feverishly and was written quickly. And then because of the way that publishing delays work, I was able to pretty much finish The Quickening Maze before The Broken Word was published. Or at least, no, I would have been writing it anyway, over that period. So it's a combination of having got to the end of a large spell of very intense work and that spell actually having lasted years previous to that time, all those years of working those jobs and using my lunch breaks and holiday allowances to write. So I had then to deal with both, an accumulated tiredness to some extent, but also the discombobulations of being published, even just for the first time. And the fact that it happened, as you say, I was very lucky with the recognition of various literary prizes. So it happened in this kind of accelerating and amplifying way over these 3 years that was something that I had to sort of assimilate. Even I remember the first time I met my first publisher was a very confusing, in some sense, experience for me because it had been so long sort of brewing. And I went from a shift at the warehouse that I was working in to an office full of, and met sort of half a dozen people who'd read my book. This is the first time I'd ever met a stranger who'd read anything I'd written. And it's a difficult transition. Can be quite sort of frightening. And I did have to learn what it means to develop a public self or a profile that you realise early on actually detaches from you and is something that you might want to kind of manage from outside, or at least know psychologically is detached from you, and not to feel panic about the fate of your external self in the world, if that makes sense.
And that very much comes on to your latest book, Dream Sequence, which has at its heart celebrity.
Mm. It's about an actor, youngish male actor, who, through one very fortunate piece of casting, has had a very successful time in a TV show that became incredibly popular, and that's gone on for a few years. There's been a bunch of seasons of that, and it's now just ended, and he is very ambitious, very anxious, and looking to transition into being another kind of actor, looking to achieve the sort of success that he thinks will allay these anxieties. So we are following him. We are also following someone who is following him from a distance, who is a fan, who has on one occasion met him, and when she did so, has had a very intense quasi-religious experience of a profound metaphysical meeting in which it was revealed to her that they are twin souls and that they ought to be together, and also that the universe is a magical place and that has its, as its central law, universal love. It's a very sweet and mystical set of perceptions that she has, and she knows that she has to find him again and engineer a situation in which they can be together, as this is what the universe clearly intends.
I love this book on so many levels. It's very much a London novel, isn't it?
It is, yes. Which a couple of my books have been in a way. I mean, but this is a very contemporary novel, and it was a novel that emerged out of wanting to engage with the culture right now and the sense of image, status, anxiety, precarity, the intensity of our hypnosis by various forms of media, and by the textures of the contemporary city. So, yeah, I was excited to do those acts of describing that take on London now. Mm.
And the whole examination of celebrity and what that means, and how people can suffer from complete illusions about celebrities that they really don't know.
Yes, I think that's clearly true. Intensified now by our sense of connectedness that exceeds even that of the past, where we would see people appear on television and in magazines. Now we have Twitter and Instagram, and even if people are not themselves using those social media platforms, as Henry doesn't, he is one of those people who thinks that avoiding it will increase his cachet. There are constant alerts and updates about those people. So it's Kristen has her Google Alerts set up for him and has a sense of being electronically connected with him also.
Which is quite extraordinary. I mean, the way the world changes. Will you go back to poetry? Are you a poet? Would you say, I mean, if you had to categorise what you were, are you both?
I would say so. I'm enjoying working in different forms, which is something I'm doing right now. I've been working on a book of essays. I've been writing something that's sort of aphoristic, short thoughts and descriptions around a particular set of themes. And I'm starting in on a new novel. I just wrote a short film for a friend. So I like expanding into different ways of writing, shapes of writing. I think the poetry is there in the prose. At least I like prose and prose writers. Saul Bellow's been mentioned. D.H. Lawrence is another, who write a prose that is very linguistically alive, where the word choices are vivid and constantly interesting, and that has breath and has rhythm. So I like a prose that has a lot of the qualities of good poetry. I would certainly like to write more poetry that would be published as The Broken Word was, in the form of a poetry book. I don't really write lyric poems, so it's a matter of another subject matter like The Broken Words demanding that form for its telling. Every so often I think about what that might be and I start some things, but I keep the door open, the invitation open, and I'll see if something comes up.
And in the interim, we have your back catalogue that we can be rereading and this wonderful new book. It's called Dream Sequence. It's published by Jonathan Cape. Adam Foles, thank you so much for coming on to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough and David Stevens and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.